community of prophecy. Well, now Judy has agreed to step in and be that prophet. You're going to experience some of the discomfort. And many of you are going to go, okay, Judy, you've quit preaching and now you've gone to meddling. But she's going to be here to remind us of something essential. And she's going to present opportunity and encouragement for her how to work, how to make that hope and vision real in our community. As Krista Tippett said, who interviews lots of people who are an awful lot smarter and more grounded than I am and perhaps many of you, she said she's going to be that prophet to help us connect the dots between what is and what might be. Judy.
I'm not sure how to live up to that. I will say we're going to leave the stones right here. No stoning. There is going to be some uncomfortability in this sermon this morning and my thoughts. But bear with me, because I think there's some hope, too.
It'll start when you show up the book.
I'll get there. As Michelle Alexander reminded us in this morning's reading, Martin Luther King's Poor People's Campaign sought to change the civil rights movement into a human rights movement, and to explicitly include poor whites, as well as poor people of all colors, in the American dream, in that mythical dream that we live in a land of equality and opportunity and can be anything we dream. King sought to change the dream from myth to potential and real opportunity. And that, my friends, is what got him killed. He was not killed for dreaming that little black boys and little white girls would be able to join hands with little white girls and little white boys as brothers and sisters. Martin Luther King Jr. was killed for challenging the pervasive class system upon which our country is founded and which perpetuates today. Because despite everything we've been taught, and here's that uncomfortable moment, the United States is and has always been a class-based society. We're sold the myth, we're taught the myth of opportunity, but for many it is really just a myth. The earliest colonies were founded, we were founded as a nation by England's waste people, and waste people have always been part of our reality. A brief tour of our 400-year history of class comes from this lovely book. Do you like the title? White Trash, by historian Nancy Eisenberg. She writes, "To subsidize the adventure of colonization, the idea of settlement had to be sold to wary investors." And this is how they sold it. Expendable people, waste people, would be unloaded from England, and their labor would germinate a distant wasteland. Thus, our early colonies were filled with England's waste people, and the system here intentionally reproduced the very class system in England that we are told they were escaping from. And I found this fact. This is a fun fact. For most of us, many of whom have chosen North Carolina as our adopted home, myself included, you may find it fascinating. I find it fascinating to note that, quote, North Carolina was the first officially white trash colony. The lazy lubbers of North Carolina stood out as a dangerous refuge of waste people and the spawning ground of a degenerate breed of Americans. Welcome home. And here, like in England, land ownership was the key to wealth in the colonies, but land rights were granted by the crown and only went to wealthy patrons. Those waste people never had access to land ownership and became squatters in the colonies. And we remember there were indentured servants, but even after they worked off their servitude, they were relegated to the worst and least valuable property, the shrubs, the swamps, the forests. With the introduction of the African slave trade, poor whites were considered an even lower class, falling below African slaves on the scale of humanity. Because owners invested in their slaves as property and valued them. But poor whites, on the other hand, were seen as a liability. During the Revolution, under the Articles of Confederation, Congress drew a very sharp line written between those entitled to the privileges of citizenship and the paupers, vagabonds, and fugitives from justice who stood outside the national community. And remember that even the original Constitution only granted the right to vote to those who owned property. Every acquisition of new territory, every time we purchased new territory, it was an opportunity for early America to recreate the British experience and move those landless squatters west. When we moved to modern America, Eisenberg writes, our reserve army of the poor are drummed into the worst jobs, the worst paid positions, and provide the labor force that works in coal mines, cleans toilets and barn stalls, picks and plucks fields as migrant workers, and slaughters animals. Waste people remain those who fill out the bottom layer of the labor pool on which society's wealth rests. We cannot understand where we are today as a nation without understanding that the United States is a deeply class-based society. And truly, our American story is the story of the intersection between race and class. We see this most dramatically in our history of slavery and the Civil War, during Reconstruction and Jim Crow, and through the new Jim Crow of the prison system, which incarcerates people of color at five times, yes, five times the rate of whites. And today, with the devastating reactivity and rise in racist hate crimes following Obama's presidency and Trump's election. These are moments in history when we clearly see how poor whites, who were and are America's original waste people, how they were sold that myth that at least they were better than people of color. I propose to you that incidents of police brutality, like we talked about from all summer and last year, still go on, and the murder of blacks by white police officers is merely the latest manifestation of pitting poor whites against people of color. Horrific as these incidents are, they are today's version of the Little Rock desegregation, of Bloody Sunday, and the lynching of freedom riders and those who fought for the right to vote. To move us forward as a nation, we need understanding and true embrace of what's being termed intersectionality. That us is all. And that the oppression and rights of women, LGBTQ persons, people of color, immigrants and migrants, people of all religions and waste people, as well as environmental and economic justice, are deeply and profoundly connected. That all identity-based movements must come together. I find hope that such a movement is beginning at a national level, and the marches for next week are all being defined as intersectional moments. This is a human movement and a hopeful movement, and it's certainly a nascent movement, and it will take lots of hard work. Identity politics is strong, but it is our only hope as a nation. A human movement, and whereas Dr. King called for 50 years ago this year in his Poor People's Campaign, a human rights movement. Our understanding and embrace of intersexuality, of a human rights movement, begins for us from our theology, our orientation, our Unitarian Universalist message. Because unlike our nation's founders, we proclaim that there are no waste people. We proclaim loudly and proudly the worth and dignity of each and the interdependence of all. We quote Martin Luther King that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. To King, we were children of God. In my language, I say we are incarnations of divinity, embodiments of the spirit of life and love, living expressions of the mystery, that all of us are blessed and beautiful. This is our religious message. This is our universalist theology, our proclamation of hope. But we do not do justice to our orientation and message and proclamation if we only share it here in this beautiful space with our friends and family. We are called to live it, to bring it into being in our days and lives. I want to be clear. This is not a social justice sermon this morning. It is a sermon about living and being, about becoming and truly walking, talking, being reflections of our message. One way is engagement with that national movement toward intersectionality. But we live here in Hendersonville, so how might we bring that message, that being of our message, into our days here? For me, the most fundamental dimension of our message is that it is a message of hope. And that is key, because I will tell you, our most vulnerable neighbors lack hope. Many years ago in Chicago, I had the opportunity to be part of an extensive research project which went into the worst housing projects of the city, for those of you familiar, Robert Taylor Homes and Cabrini Green, and asked residents if they believed in the American dream, if they believed that their children had the possibility that their lives would be better than their parents. It was called by the university a social opportunity survey. But for me, it was really a question of hope. And this question was asked to the poor, mostly black underclass in this major U.S. city in the late 80s and early 90s. And the result? Hope was very absent from those conversations. And sadly, I find similar responses about the lack of hope among the poorest in our community. And I'm not alone. In conversations recently with a leading physician who happens to be known as the Director of Innovation for MAHEC, the Mountain Area Health Education Center, which trains physicians in our community, and in a conversation with the CEO of a local hospital, both independently diagnosed the most critical concern for our community is lack of hope among our most vulnerable. Why? Because as a nation, we have told poor folks, white, brown, and black, that they are waste people and that they do not really matter. And we have never really created opportunities for them to matter, for them to have hope. Now, some of you will argue policies with me here and point to the New Deal or Great Society. But I ask you to consider this historical reality and not what we've been sold through propaganda. Writes Eisenberg, whether it is New Deal policies or LBJ's welfare programs or Obama-era health care reform, along with any effort to address inequality and poverty comes a harsh and seemingly inevitable reaction. Angry citizens lash out. They perceive government bending over backwards to help the poor, implied or stated undeserving poor. They accuse bureaucrats of wasteful spending that steals from hardworking men and women. In the larger scheme of things, the modern complaint against state intervention echoes the old, here we go, that old English, back to our colonization, fear of social leveling, which is said to encourage the unproductive. And in this moment of backlash, America's waste people are again told that they do not matter, that the dream is not theirs, and that there is no reason for hope. So what does it mean to offer hope? Hope arises from a sense of possibility, a sense of self-efficacy, and a sense of connection. And all three dimensions are critical: possibility, self-efficacy, and connection. But for me, perhaps the most vital dimension is that sense of self-efficacy or self-worth, that I matter and my actions do matter. Hope does not arise from charity. Charity can put food on the table, but it does not come close to offering hope because it does not offer that sense of possibility and connection and self-efficacy. And sadly, charity often comes with judgment by the giver for the recipient's situation, as well as a sense of making the giver feel a whole lot better or even superior, which then reinforces that judgment. Offering hope only comes through walking with and deeply engaging another. Only through deep engagement can we offer that sense of connection, nurture a sense of self-efficacy in another, and suggest, hint at possibilities. And this kind of deep engagement is a profoundly spiritual or religious path of true encounter and interaction. Echoing Martin Buber's I-Thou encounter, it is an intentional path of connectivity that explicitly orients to nurture the worth of another by seeing, hearing, and engaging them as a profound and blessed human being. Well, what does that really mean? It's nice words. Am I suggesting that we walk through all of our days attempting to intentionally engage everyone as a blessed human being? Perhaps. I leave that question to each of you. But for the purpose of this morning's exploration of intersectionality, economic justice, and hope for our most vulnerable, I want to offer up the example of the life-changing work we have been doing at the clinics for the last few years. Most of you know that my day job is serving as the executive director of the free clinics. And most of you know that the clinics offers free health care to low-income, uninsured persons in our community thanks to the dedication of 270-plus volunteers and 170-plus health and community partners. Some of you are volunteers and supporters of our work, and for that, I deeply thank you. But most of you do not really understand what we do. And I can say that because, frankly, when I talk to people all over our community, I find that there is a shared assumption that our clinic focuses on acute care. But the reality is, acute care is only 10% of our work. Organizationally, we began changing about 8 years ago to focus on deep, deep engagement with the most vulnerable in our community. Those with complex medical conditions, mental health challenges, often substance abuse struggles, and extreme social and economic deprivation. These are the other 1%, the bottom 1%, who do not fit well within our healthcare system as it is currently designed. And due to their complex conditions, who drive 25% of healthcare costs nationwide. And yes, that is a real statistic. 1% of our nation drives 25% of all healthcare costs. At the clinics, when we began this work, we had a two-pronged goal: to improve these patients' health and to reduce their uncompensated hospital expenses. But with this program, we found our niche, our calling, our ministry. But don't tell anybody I said that, because I'm not supposed to use that word about a secular nonprofit. It's our secret. This fall, our original program with these most vulnerable patients was recognized with a national award because we changed the lives of the hardest and the hard in three fundamental ways. First, we do improve their health outcomes. Have you ever heard of that 95% of any cohort of people with diabetes have a healthy blood sugar, much less those who are the most vulnerable? We decreased hospital utilization and uncompensated costs by over $2.5 million in 6 years. $2.5 million at our local hospitals. But the most dramatic and surprising part to us, the part we didn't plan for, was that our engagement has significantly improved their social outcomes like housing and employment. And as we've walked, we've learned and deepened our engagement with this ministry. And we've continued to add programs that the patients, these vulnerable persons, have themselves requested. So that now the clinics invest almost half of all of our resources in working with the most vulnerable and addressing their social barriers to health, in addition to our original purpose of providing access to care. But perhaps, and this is the sermon this morning, the most fundamental shift for all of us is the how. How we engage in an intentional encounter with another human being, another blessed human being. We see them first as people. We talk with them as people and ask them about their needs and desires. And then we listen, truly listen. We work with them to set their own personal goals, not ours. Our medical team may want them to eat better, take their medications, lower their blood sugars or blood pressures, exercise, quit smoking, whatever. But that person may want shoes for their children, tires for their car, a warm sleeping bag, or help getting a fishing license so they can supplement their meals. We listen without judgment as much as possible, and we walk with them to meet their own personal goals. And when we do so, these most vulnerable persons engage. They feel valued and heard and that their voices matter, when that voice may not have mattered for most of their lives. Last spring, Will walked up to me one afternoon and said, "I'm having a hard time today." And I said, "Why?" And his response was heartbreaking to me. He said, "You believe in me. You believe I can do this. And no one in my life," and this man is my age, "no one in my life has ever believed in me." And I said, "Well, I believe in you. I believe you can do this. And so does everyone in this room, in this building." And he teared up, and he gulped a few times and gave me a hug. And then he went outside and built 3 raised beds for the community garden that he and his peers requested and needed to grow their own food. We have learned not to do for these vulnerable persons, but to encourage and enable their ability to do for themselves. We do not give out fish, if you will. Instead, we offer fishing poles, fishing lessons, and assistance in procuring a fishing license so they can fish for themselves. And as they begin to meet their own personal goals, those that are most important to them, their self-confidence grows, their voice grows, and they create and work towards more challenging goals. It is walking with, giving voice, and offering community and emotional support that gives hope in ways that charity never can. It has become the ministry of the clinics, and it starts from living that message of worth and dignity, not judgment or charity, with engagement and intentional encounter with each person as a blessed human being. And it's been life-changing for us. Yet to truly enter into relationship and engage, we must suspend judgment as much as possible and come to each moment with that religious orientation that each person is a truly blessed human being. It also requires that we develop an understanding of poverty, and especially generational poverty, an understanding of the institutional and historical forces that create waste people and limit real opportunity. And an understanding that living in severe poverty is living in constant crisis, giving rise to PTSD and actually changing brain function. Here in this congregation, we spent last fall looking deeply at issues of race. And in order to do the work of intersectionality, we must also do the work of deeply looking at issues of poverty and class, to understand the ugly forces that create and perpetuate it. In order to do the work of intersectionality, we must do the work of deeply looking at poverty and class to understand the ugly forces that create and perpetuate it. and which create the divisiveness. This work is calling to us in the wake of the election and all the conversations we have and have been having about missing the anger of the white, underclass white folks. Doing this work is the only way we can create a true human rights movement. We must do the work. And it is spirit work. Why do it? Why, as a successful retiree who's in the relaxed prime, why do it? Because it is about living our faith. Our theology espouses that all are worthy, but how deeply does that belief go without our living? If we merely profess a belief without living into it, we are not fully honoring spirit or ourselves. But how deeply can we live it without a sense of understanding? To do the work and enable understanding, Jim and I are planning to offer a series of on class and poverty. We've also discussed creating deeper relations between the clinics and this congregation to give you opportunities to walk with us in the clinic's ministry. And because we are changing, I'm talking about opportunities that are not clinical. We started a Bikes for Life program to rehabilitate and recycle donated bikes so that our most vulnerable can have transportation. Last summer, we launched a small community garden, but have the potential to cultivate up to an acre this year. In March, we will be piloting a new community health program, training lay people as educators to empower their communities. And Jim and I are discussing how we might create linkages for personal relationships, akin to that old FaithLink program many of you participated in. And frankly, there will likely be other opportunities I cannot foresee, because I could tell you that 6 months ago I didn't know we'd be doing what we're about to do. All of these programs are person-driven, requested, nurtured, and staffed by the most vulnerable to meet their own needs and to give back. See, economic justice is about quality jobs and raising the minimum wage and safe and affordable housing and healthy food and health care and education. But the extent to which each of those issues really matter to a vulnerable person is muted when you have no sense of hope. Someone who has been told, inculcated, socialized to believe they are a waste person, those economic issues are just not as relevant. In our work with Nicole to get a job, every time she came close to employment, she would panic and tell us that her family couldn't work. So before we could enable her to take that final step into employment, and that overwhelming sense of pride that resulted for her, we had to unpack and understand that what she was saying was a generational expression of poverty. And then we had to nurture her self-worth to step beyond the message of waste and unworthiness. To act for economic justice and embrace King's most challenging dream, the dream that got him killed, we must do the work. We must learn and understand class, bias, judgments, and history. We must engage in real ways that live into the dignity of all. And we must walk with our vulnerable neighbors to share knowledge, skills, and resources, not as charity, but as tools for our neighbors to find hope, to sense possibility, to find connection, and to develop their own sense of self-efficacy so they can achieve their own goals. Then we are creating the change we want to see. Then we are living into our theology, our orientation, and our message of hope. Then we are building that beloved community here at home.